Theater for Beginners is your honest doorway into the stage where civilizations learn to think out loud. In each episode, one writer and one living question. Why does this still hit us in the chest? No jargon, no gatekeeping. Just story, stakes, and the human choices that won't sit quietly. You'll meet the architects of drama and comedy from Athens to Edo to London. Aeschylus turning grief into law, Sophocles giving conscience a spine, Euripides dragging the sacred into the kitchen, Aristophanes laughing politics back to its senses, Zemi shaping silence, Shakespeare setting language on fire. You leave each episode with more than a plot. You leave with a tool, how to argue without cheating, how to spot a pretty lie, how to stand your ground without becoming stone. If you've ever felt theater was for other people, this is for you. One clear voice, rich storytelling, scenes you can see in your mind, and the quiet conviction that old plays are not homework, they're field guides for today. He enters the Roman stage as both a philosopher and a dramatist, a man who wrote essays to cool the blood and tragedies that make the blood run hot, and that contradiction is the point rather than the problem. Lucius Aeneas Seneca, counselor of emperors, exile of Corsica, victim of an ordered suicide, stands at the hinge where Stoic ethics meets theatrical thunder. If you want to know what Stoicism sounds like when it breathes in a city that loves spectacle, listen to the sentences that crack like whips and the choruses that plead for moderation as if moderation were a glass bowl carried through a riot. The Stoic tells us that passion is a judgment we can revise. The tragedian shows what happens when a judgment recruits the whole universe to help it burn. Between those two voices, there is not hypocrisy but instruction. The dramas are laboratories for the essays, and the essays are manuals to clean up after the laboratories have exploded. He lived the double life that makes his work feel modern. In the letters to Lucilius and the dialogues on anger, on clemency, on the shortness of life, he writes like a physician of the soul with a firm hand and a soft bedside voice. Anger, he says, is a form of temporary madness, a false syllogism acted out by the body. Therefore, train the mind to interrupt the syllogism before it reaches the fist. Wealth is merely a loan from fortune. Therefore, travel light so that the inevitable recall notice does not rip joy out by the roots. Power, even at its brightest, is a plague that flatters the patient while it consumes him. Therefore, speak truth to princes with a smile and a plan to survive. Then he walks to a different desk, takes up the theatrical voice, and writes Thyestes, Medea, Phaedra, Oedipus, Agamemnon, Troas, Hercules, Furens, plays that seem to contradict the serenity of the treatises until you notice what they are doing to your nerves. They are not sermons, they are stress tests. You watch other people's mistakes until you can feel your own pulse learning the shape of caution. Start with the stage he writes for. Greek tragedy was a civic ceremony with a chorus, masks, a dancing floor, and daylight. The city judged itself in the sun. Roman tragedy in the first century is a different animal. The plays could be recited in villas or small theaters, performed with music and gesture as much as with sets. The audiences were trained in declamation at school, where imagination practiced on hypothetical cases. What should Alexander do if offered peace that saves honor but loses land? What should a tyrant's son say when asked to convict his father? What does clemency require when law says death and the crowd says blood? Those exercises did not make Rome gentle, but they did make it precise about motives. Seneca writes for ears that like the feel of argument. That is why his tragedies sound like trials. Witnesses appear, proofs are offered, the chorus deliberates, and a verdict, often a terrible one, arrives with the elegance of grammar. Thyestes is the black masterpiece. Atreus, a king, wants to punish his brother Thyestes for betrayal. Punishment in archaic myth is often symmetric, eye for eye, but Seneca's Atreus aims higher. He wants revenge that both inflicts and instructs, a rhetorical revenge that teaches the world his superiority. He will kill Thyestes' sons, cook them, and serve them at a feast, then reveal the truth at the moment when the appetite that has consumed what it loves most is ready to say grace. Horror is an old recipe, but Seneca seasons it with theory. Atreus debates technique, judges that ordinary cruelty is pedestrian, and decides that the greatest pleasure is to educate his victim with astonishment. The language matches the ambition. Fire, smoke, altars, knives, stars that turn their faces away, cosmic accessories attend a kitchen crime. When the messenger reports the murders, the report is so elaborately crafted that the narrative becomes its own kind of altar. Philosophy is not absent. The chorus warns that kings should fear their own wishes, that the universe keeps accounts, that the tallest towers call down the harshest winds. But the chorus speaks like a conscience that the play has already outpaced. We are forced to feel how eloquence can serve a will that hates limits. The achievement is terrifying because we recognize the logic, to make a point so absolute that no counterexample can live. Medea is a manual on the physics of passion. In Euripides, Medea kills her children after a fierce argument with herself and the city, and the play, for all its shock, is a debate about exile, marriage, and the state's fear of the clever foreign woman. In Seneca, the knife is sharpened in a language that sees through itself and keeps cutting. He gives Medea an interior weather that makes meteorology jealous. Fire lives in her metaphors. Dragons and chariots are images of will, not props. When she names herself, Medea nunc sum, now I am Medea, she does not mean that she has discovered a tender identity. She means that the world has finally removed its disguises and allowed her the luxury of being as cruel as her wrong. The murders are not accidents of rage. They are the grammar of a mind that has concluded that civilization is a lie told by the comfortable. One of the unnerving achievements here is that the rhetoric is so beautiful you almost join the crime. Seneca does not seduce you into approval so much as he forces you to recognize how easily language can perform anesthesia on conscience. Phaedra shows another vector of the same dynamo. Desire here is a speech problem. The queen loves her stepson Hippolytus, a hunter who worships chastity like a religion. She cannot contain the wish, and the nurse, a manager of household crises, provides the instrument, words. Suppose we call the thing by its name in a safe room. Suppose we speak and the speaking disburdens. Suppose the right narrative, sickness cured by confession, saves a queen and a dynasty. It is a very Roman supposition. Seneca, who knows how words heal when used with care, shows how words also poison when used with an agenda. The nurse's rhetoric does not manage desire. It organizes it and gives it a strategy. A false accusation, a father's curse, a broken body under the hooves of horses. The plot runs like an orator's hand over smooth wood. The chorus prays for a simple life far from the palace. As usual in Seneca, the prayer is both sincere and powerless. Virtue ahead of the fact is advice. Virtue after the fact is elegy. Oedipus in Seneca is not a riddle but a forensic nightmare. The plague has logic. Cause must be located, witnesses examined, testimony weighed, and sentence pronounced. Tiresias performs not so much divination as legal discovery. The ghost of Laius is not a poetic conceit but a summoned witness. Jocasta pleads like a mother in a courtroom. When recognition arrives, it is accompanied by a sensory catalog. Hands that touched where they should not have, eyes that looked where they should not, roads that crossed at an hour they should not, blood that obeyed patterns older than the city's law. Stoicism here is not a lecture but a background hum. The universe is rational and you are part of it whether you like it or not. The rationality is terrible because it does not care for innocence. Oedipus does not intend, he discovers. And discovery itself becomes a form of punishment that a Stoic would recognize. Knowledge without preparation is a scourge. Hercules' furens puts glory on trial. Strength, so loved by empire, is paired with fury, the passion Stoicism most fears. In the play, the hero returns from the underworld to find his house threatened by a petty tyrant. He saves it, then, in a sudden fit sent by a goddess and facilitated by an ungoverned habit of triumph, he murders his wife and children in a hallucination. When the fog clears, he sees red truth. What good is strength if it lacks governance? What is a hero who cannot govern himself? The chorus answers with the standard Roman remedies: measure, patience, rural peace, humble tasks. And for once the advice feels almost adequate. The spectacle has been so awful that even rhetoric begins to sound like medicine. Agamemnon and Troades look at war's residue with a lawyer's cold compassion. In Agamemnon, Clytemnestra's vengeance for Iphigenia is not only a mother's rage, it is prosecution. Everyone is guilty: the king who killed a child for a wind, the gods who accepted the offering, the sailors who boarded anyway, the chorus that sang while the knife cut. Cassandra's prophecies arrive like footnotes to a history that is already written. In Troades, the women of Troy describe captivity as a regime of paperwork. Lots drawn, names read, assignments made, civilization reorganizing grief into a distribution of slaves. A queen becomes a prize, a child becomes ballast. The language refuses to look away. It catalogs ships and fabrics and the logic of plunder until a listener's mind learns what it would rather not. Everyone feels the pressure of biography in these plays. Seneca was tutor and then counselor to Nero. He wrote on clemency at the start of Nero's reign, explaining that a ruler's mercy is both beautiful and useful, the perfume of power that prevents rot. He helped stage early magnanimity and then watched the young emperor invent entertainments with real blood. He retired or tried to, and the empire would not let him. Accused in the Piconian conspiracy, he was ordered to die. He slit his veins and performed a lesson in composure that later ages would call theatrical. It is tempting to make the tragedies mere allegories of this career, as if Atreus were Nero in costume and the choruses were Seneca's frightened conscience. The temptation should be resisted but not denied. What gives the plays their urgency is precisely that they are not topical pamphlets that die with the day, they are mythic machines tuned to a pitch that any tyranny can play. Style is ethic. The Latin is Baroque before the Baroque. It likes antithesis, balance, the sudden reversal that turns a clause into a verdict. Seneca hammers with parallelism because the moral life he imagines is made of paired alternatives: assent or refusal, appetite or judgment, boast or silence. Those tight, glittering sentences that turn up everywhere in his work are not ornaments. They are training weights. The mind lifts them and grows stronger. A tyrant wants oceans. Seneca gives him a drop and asks if he can taste the salt without drowning. A crowd wants thunder. He gives it lightning, quick and exact, a flash that shows the terrain and dares you to walk it with your eyes open. The verbal surface is hard because the ethics beneath it are hard. He does not indulge the audience with softness. He lends them edge. Sound becomes a civic instrument in his hands. A long-breathed period carries you as if on a ritual procession, past shrines of argument and altars of example, so that by the end of the sentence you have rehearsed the very patience you will need when your temper rises. Then a single-line maxim drops like a hammer on a nail, straight, bright, irrevocable. That alternation is moral pedagogy disguised as style. You learn endurance from his cadences and decision from his cuts. He wants you capable of both staying with a thought and cutting a thought off before it harms. The art teaches the posture. This is why the violence in the tragedies can be so spectacular without becoming pornography. He is not staging blood because blood excites. He is staging force because force is what language becomes when it forgets it was made to serve truth. Atreus is a stylist who has baptized his cruelty in eloquence. Medea is a logician who has decided that reason exists to ratify decisions the will has already made. Phaedra is a patient who mistakes speech for cure and ends by turning words into weapons. In each case, rhetoric misuses its charter. That misuse is the point. The plays are demonstrations of what happens when verbal power is divorced from self-rule. If you walk out of a reading with your palate sweetened by horror rather than sharpened by recognition, you have missed the intention. The plays are laboratories. The mess is the lesson. The reach of that laboratory explains the afterlife. When Renaissance humanists had Seneca's tragedies but not Aeschylus or Sophocles at hand, they learned from him how to make thought audible, how to weight a scene with maxims that feel like iron coins in the palm, how to let revenge defend itself with philosophy. English drama in particular grew a Senecan skeleton. Put your ear to the soliloquies of the next millennium and you can hear Rome in them. The inner trial, the self-calling witnesses, the verdict arriving in sentences polished like instruments. A ghost can speak like a prosecutor because Seneca gave writers the grammar for an accusation that is also a revelation. The Elizabethan appetite for catastrophe that teaches, crimes designed as curriculum, draws straight from Thyestes' kitchen and Medea's cold arithmetic. But the chorus is not a museum piece imported from Greece, it is a Stoic organ planted in Rome. Between the acts of ferocity it sings the country of enough. Fields unambitious, tables unpretending, friendships that would rather keep time than keep score. It cannot save the characters. Their velocity is too great. It can save a listener who remembers the song later in a crowded day. Seneca is staging habits of attention. The chorus gives the audience a portable cadence to hum against the city's noise, a rhythm of counsel that outlives the spectacle that threatened to drown it. The declamatory schools loved extreme cases, so Seneca chooses extreme cases and runs cold experiments on them. What if vengeance educates? What if confession corrupts? What if truth kills? He pushes circumstance to the edge not because he worships the edge but because edges reveal structure. Under pressure, the moral joints of a life show themselves. You discover which maxims you actually trust when the room tilts. Seneca tilts rooms for a living. The treatises then offer railings. The old question, did he live what he taught, will not retire and it should not. His proximity to Nero, his immense wealth, his staged withdrawal, his deliberate death. These facts sharpen the audience's skepticism and make easy sainthood impossible. Yet the suspicion that he wrote from inside temptation is also the credential that makes his therapy practical. The prose knows how money flatters and how power shortens the distance between wish and want. The plays know how a talented mind can turn excuses into engines. A weak moralist is a man who has never met his own seductions. Seneca met them, negotiated with them, sometimes lost, and then wrote. The work sounds like experience distilled rather than innocence preaching. Rome understood performance as civic technology, so he composes with an engineer's eye for use. Messenger speeches are crisis communications. They teach you to tell the worst truth with such pace and detail that disbelief has no foothold. Choral odes are public health announcements. They repeat the same thing beautifully enough that a city will hum it while standing in line. Debate scenes are executive memos that stage options and conflict to test their load-bearing. Even the scenic excess, storms, omens, gods reluctant to look, functions as a lesson in perspective. Your catastrophe feels world-sized. The play borrows the world to show you what your catastrophe will try to do to scale. The cure is not to shrink the feeling by force but to recover measure by thought. He never promises a life without grief. Stoicism at its best is not optimism but competence. The letters explain how to keep a morning quiet and what to do when a guest arrives with the gift of a wasted hour. They recommend rehearsals of loss so the first theft of fortune does not also steal your composure. The dramas then show the texture of failure. After you have watched Hercules slaughter his children under a godsent delusion, you know exactly why a Stoic cares about guarding the frontier of ascent. A single thought admitted without inspection can recruit the whole person. The theater is a map of recruitment routes. Craft instruction hides in the scenes for anyone who builds performances. Seneca calibrates tension and release with medical precision. He will hold a nerve taut across pages, then let the chorus loosen the fist so that blood can return to the hand. He will deliver an accumulation thick as smoke, then lance it with a one-line admission that clears the air. He gives villains arguments so clean that an audience finds its head nodding and then is forced to recognize the nod as complicity. That recognition is part of the cure. You catch your appetite applauding and teach it shame without teaching it self-hatred. Many playwrights can arouse. Fewer can educate the part of the self that arousal makes stupid. Seneca attempts that education scene by scene. A paradox runs through the work and energizes it. A philosopher who preached indifference to spectacle becomes one of antiquity's great stage engineers. The paradox dissolves if you notice the pedagogy. He is not celebrating spectacle. He is domesticating it. A people that worships fire will not submit to lectures delivered with cold water. They must be taught by flames that obey a better geometry. He takes the city's love of display and harnesses it to the chariot of self-rule. The horses still run. The reins are different. The resulting shows are not pious, they are useful. His last scene completes the curriculum. A doctrine had long preceded it. Death is the door fortune cannot lock. The wise leave it unbarred in thought, not out of despair but out of competence. When the order came, he obeyed, and he staged the obedience, because staging is how Rome sealed truth in memory. Some readers dislike the theatricality. Seneca would say the theater is how bodies learn. A posture, a tone of voice, a sequence of actions performed calmly under an irreversible sentence. These are not decorations. They are a grammar the frightened can imitate. The essays give you lines to say to yourself. The final act gives you a scene to copy if you must. What does a beginner in theater need from him now? An ear, a thermometer, and a habit. First, the ear for how language acts. In his world, a figure of speech arrives with intention. Hyperbole wants to seize a crown. Antithesis wants to judge. Metaphor wants to smuggle meaning past a guard. If you can hear these motives, you can write scenes in which talk does something measurable. Second, the sense of moral temperature. His tragedies are thermostats that show how quickly a room heats when one person abandons governance. After 10 pages with Atreus, you will never again call anger a small weather. Third, the habit of pause. The letters train the tiny hinge motions. Breathe before assent. Sleep before reply, decline before resentment matures, that keep human beings from becoming engines of their own ruin. Those hinges are stagecraft for the soul. Comfort exists here if you are willing to accept its scale. The chorus's praise of enough is not naivete, it is bravery in a culture that mistakes noise for value. There is rebellion in an early night and a short table. Seneca, who knew how to make a palace applaud, spent some of his finest sentences defending rooms no courtier would visit. The defense is not flight but governance. A person who learns to enjoy little places has a chance of governing large ones without panic. Hold treatise and tragedy in one hand and you see the rotation he designed. After Thyestes, you need on anger to remind you that rage is a posture you can unlearn. After on clemency, you need Medea to warn you that a city can turn justice into polished cruelty. He alternates shock with counsel so no single tone colonizes the whole person. It is a humane architecture. Storms to reveal the coastline, lighthouses to make the return possible. Bring the whole apparatus into the present and the usefulness is almost embarrassing. We live in amphitheaters. Our feeds are choruses, our headlines are messenger speeches. Our public life is a string of cases posed in declamatory form. Anger has a business model, confession is a commodity, revenge sells tickets. Seneca is not an antique curiosity in such a world. He is a technician on call. When your attention is dragged to the edge of appetite, borrow one of his drills. Ask what judgment you just assented to and whether the body needed that order. When a wrong begs you to educate the perpetrator with pain, remember Atreus and refuse the pedagogy of knives. When your day offers you the glittering banquet of small self-betrayals, hear a chorus praising a garden you could actually maintain. Even his most familiar metaphors can be turned into practice. He likes the sea, so trim your sails. In work that means calendars with room to steer and budgets that assume storms. He likes architecture, so inspect your beams. In habit that means a morning check simple enough to complete and strong enough to fortify. He likes medicine, so prescribe to yourself what you would advise a friend. Slower talk, fewer promises, appetite that waits for hunger. None of that refuses the world. It organizes the self so the world cannot conscript it at will. Return to style because he always does. He loves hinges, said Kia et temen verum, little joints where a clause turns and the meaning begins to serve a different master. Life is made of such joints. The tragedy show doors slammed and blown off their frames. The letters teach the oiling that keeps them from sticking at the hour of need. That is his deepest unity. He is teaching a citizen how to keep interior architecture flexible under pressure so that choice is not crushed by the first touch of weather. So the man who wrote essays to cool the blood and tragedies that make the blood run hot does not leave us with contradiction but with a craft. Calm is not a climate, it is seamanship. Rhetoric is not an enemy of truth, it is a tool that lies or serves depending on the hand that wields it. Power is not a throne, it is a habit of judgment available to anyone who can pause in the heat, prefer the real to the loud, and choose again when appetite has already started to run. If you want one sentence to carry into a difficult room, make it something like this. The mind is free when it remembers that it can stop, look twice, and only then consent. Everything else in Seneca is a rehearsal for that motion.